narrative.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Ford's Narrative. My name is Paul, your host for the Bella Lost Souls podcast. I'm joined this afternoon by Red Powell.
Hey, hey.
Yo, man. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's nice to be back on.
Yeah, man. Thanks for joining me. I wanted to get you on specifically to talk about close combat, what we know about the board shrinking, what we learned today about monsters and vehicles getting to shoot in some capacity. I mean, not getting the neg one. Can, in your opinion, do you think assault armies are going to be viable?
Yes, absolutely. I think that assault armies, shrinking the board, you know, taking of course, we're understanding minimum values, taking a foot off of one end and a few inches on the other is absolutely in the melee army's favor to a certain extent. I mean, you think about, I'll speak from somewhat of a position of experience in regards of berserkers as I was looking at this math that, okay, so I can start nine inches up the field with world eaters. So that's, we've got that. If I start in a vehicle, that's, 3.99 inches up, and then their movement of six. And then we're assuming we'll say no psychic powers in this regard, but that's still, the distance is closing rapidly when you take hammer and anvil and pointy hammer and anvil are no longer the sincerest threats that they were to melee armies that, that they used to be.
Adding a whole additional turn. I mean, really, added what is almost insurmountable hurdle of physical distance, the physics of it.
Yeah. I mean, because arguably, so you could say they took whatever 6 inches off of either side. So your army, your opponents are that much closer. I mean, there's some units, take like a Disco Lord, for example, with warp time. And there's plenty of other units that you could use warp time on. I'm just one of the previous staples from 8th edition in Chaos. But I think a Disco Lord can get to the back lines without any issue. Now, of course, that's where screaming units come into play and the tactics that you might use to try and halt a melee army. But the melee armies definitely have the ability to make that distance. I mean, it's just mathematically there. They have it there.
In the new board setup.
In the new board setup. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I like that. And I think that what we perceived as a buff to assault armies, which is there because of what you just described, we've also seen a buff to vehicles and stuff. So do you think that counterbalances it, or could we be on equal footing now?
This new deal they just highlighted today, big guns never tire, and the bonus to heavy weapons or to non-infantry units essentially no longer having a -1 to hit with heavy weapons.
I think that is absolutely amazing, because there are things like the Vendetta that have been absolute just wallpaper, essentially just there on your shelf, collecting dust because of that.
Heck, one rule.
Vultures that were good enough to take before, with in certain situations, I think are huge.
Oh, yeah. Buff. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, any of those, I was laughing. A friend of mine was talking about how essentially every army is an Iron Hands army, more or less. Of course, they don't all have rerolling ones, but no longer having the penalty to heavy weapons is huge. I mean, you talk about the balance across the board. That's just such a big deal. And then we play it into the next level of what they talked about today with monsters and vehicles being able to shoot into combat. So they did something, which I know it seems like a minor thing, and I don't want to nitpick on it too much. And this is not a bad thing. This is a good thing. But the definition, they used this term that we're starting to see, engagement range. And and that, we haven't had, I may be mistaken, but we haven't really seen that used up until more recently with this talk of 9th edition, an engagement range, which is really, and they kind of alluded to it in the article. I'll wait for 9th edition before I see the official definition. But they did say, this is any models within 1 inch of an enemy model is in engagement range. And so it's just, having a term and a definition tied to it makes it kind of clean cut. It's pretty clear. So that's
That's one of the things that's been sorely lacking from our previous is defined terms, like a glossary of terms. Is the tax a capital A or a lowercase a? Like those are big things for us that like to pick apart the rules.
Right. Well, and so now the vehicles and the monsters in engagement range, they can allocate their weapons outside of the unit that they're targeting, but they have to kill the unit that's within engagement range before they can shoot units outside of engagement range. And so going back to tying this back to melee armies now have to factor in. And I do, with your question in regards to the balance, I do think that that's a pretty fair balance. And okay, so shortening the melee armies have a lot going on. You know, we have terrain, shortening of a board. There's probably a little more to it that we don't know about yet, but those two factors are a nice benefit, obscuring terrain, so on and so forth. Those are great. It getting into combat, you can't just run a couple models into combat with a vehicle that has really big guns. It'll be able, you know, if it doesn't die and it survives, it's going to be able to shoot its wealth of weaponry into combat. Now, in that case, it will be at minus one from what they stated in the articles today. And then if it does successfully kill it and it was already allocated to targets beyond the engagement range, it can then shoot those weapons. If it, you know, has killed the assaulting unit or whatever is in engagement range, it can then attack and destroy enemies outside of engagement range, yeah, which I think that's a pretty cool process.
Took on like a whole long sentence. Like, what is it doing now? What we get the idea is that you can declare your shots and you can declare some of them you can declare them to targets you might not be able to interact with until you eliminate the unit you're right next to also with your shots. So how you resolve those attacks seems to be important.
It is. Yeah. And, you know, and that's to a point we saw something similar to that in the nuance of melee when you would charge multiple units, but you'd only engage the first unit and then you could fall in on the second unit and still fight them, so on and so forth. You know, there's other things. And so you're seeing a little bit more nuance to the shooting phase. And this is very much important to melee armies. And this is where, you know, I was considering today in regards of horde armies or having enough units, you know, being able to get the weight and momentum behind the melee units that you're putting into the fight, because you can't afford for them to get reduced to such an extent that they're destroyed. And then you have these vehicles that have a lot of things going for them, shooting out of combat into other units.
Yeah, I'm digging it. I mean, I can't say that like a Ball Predator is going to be amazing, or even a Lehman Russ with heavy bolters is going to be amazing until we see the full complements and points cost in that stuff, but I'm at least digging here.
Yeah, well, and that's I'm interested. You know, they alluded to they're going to talk more about blast weapons here very soon. I'm interested to see what exactly that means, because, like you said, a tank with a flamer on it could come through pretty well, especially, you know, some of the Space Marines that have the ability to really capitalize on those flamer weapons.
Well, it's always been like a punch in the gut. Like, okay, I've got relatively short range weaponry. I have to get up close to do it. But if I'm not laser precision with my movements, or even sometimes if I am, then I'm only going to get one turn out of use with this thing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, you really have to weigh that out. And so that's where I think Imperial Guard, you know, has some interesting, and of course, we're just going off of what they've shared with us. We don't have all the information.
Points are going to be huge in this. Like if
that's right.
You know, I mentioned this on the last show, but if tanks get some really great rules, but they also, let's say they get a 20% rules buff, but then they go up by 30%, then you're really not seeing more of the table.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So it's, you know, this, the points do matter. I don't want to even insinuate that they might not matter, but that's how we need to see how an army comes together. But again, I'm just liking the idea of function stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, we saw from 7th edition to 8th edition, we saw flamers go up pretty significantly in cost, and who knows with point inflation or however they go about rating it, who knows if that's what's going to be in 9th edition, if flamers go up even more because they recognize the value of it in melee. For vehicles and such.
It's so weird. Like, well, I don't have the points to take a flamer. I might as well take this plasma cannon.
Right. I mean, that's, you know, that Bale Predator may be one of the more expensive units.
Maybe
we just don't know.
Points, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'll tell you what, out of this vehicle material, something that, and of course, you know, we still need to see some of the stuff, but again, some of my friends discussing it, pretty excited about it. When you consider the AdMech armies and the Castellan robots they have, they are all individually vehicles. And so talking about melee armies, when I saw those robots across the field, I knew I just needed to reach out and touch them to be able to stop them from shooting me. but now they, if they can shoot into melee at -1 to hit, I mean, that's pretty significant.
That's
buff
really not
for them.
That big of a detriment, because you've got ways to buff them, and the new engine war and stuff is makes them even more deadly with extra strength and stuff. I mean, that's a really good point.
Yeah, something to be for sure. I mean, again, melee armies are just going to have to prioritize exactly how they get there and how much of a punch you need to commit. Because really, it comes down to a point of you know, can you reduce the target that you're trying to assault down to prevent it, so even if it does survive, it won't be able to unleash upon you with, you know, I mean, a Castellan robot, the amount of fire it can put out can reduce hordes, really.
And let's talk a moment about the Dread Knight.
Mm.
All the thing I've been advocating for now going on 3 years is going to get even deadlier because it can fire all those weapons into close combat now.
Yeah. No, I mean, and -1 to hit, doesn't he already hit on twos?
I believe it hits on twos, and I think you can make it a Grandmaster, which means it could potentially reroll those.
Yeah. And so, I mean, okay, so it hits on threes into combat. Like, that's awesome. With those guns it has, like, that's a lot of firepower to put out.
Yeah, I think it's going to be very difficult to tie those things up. I mean,
I would agree.
I mean, look, I'm kind of being tongue in cheek or whatever, but the fact that these things might incidentally benefit from some rules changes is really exciting.
Well, and this is, I mean, yeah, that those, you know, your point you bring up with the Dread Knight really emphasizes not just Dread Knights, but Dreadnoughts. You know, Dreadnoughts across the board are going to have quite a significant bonus, all being vehicles. The people who really miss out on this, who have been kind of taking advantage of not having the vehicle keyword, has been the Tau suits. Of course, you know, they could always fly and get out for the most part, but suits didn't have vehicles. And so I don't know. I'm interested to see if that changes or that adjusts or something to give them that benefit.
Yeah, very good point. And Leviathan Dreadnoughts too. They've been one of those, they've been kind of a mainstay in a lot of Marine builds and centered around them. And, you know, you said you wanted to touch them. And unless they were kind of a specific chapter, that was all you had to do. And now there's no safe space from them.
There is not, especially those storm cannons. I mean, that's just enough shots. They're, of course, you know, they'll be hitting on threes. I really don't think that's a big concern for a Space Marine player going, or, you know, in a lot of these cases, we're talking Imperial players, just going from twos to threes just isn't that big of a deal.
Yeah, fair enough. Oh, you mentioned some way about how you think that melee armies may be able to overcome this. What were your thoughts on that?
I mean, so, you know, sometimes you look at spreading out and you look at considering, I mean, of course, so if I had a Leviathan Dread, and let's say just somehow I had a Dread Knight also that I'm staring down, right? You've got two bad choices, you know, and that is the right and proper definition of a dilemma. So if, let's say you've got these two, and my recommendation in regards to melee armies is, as long as you have the weight to pull it off, I would focus one down, not leave, you know, I because of that capability that they'd have, I would absolutely focus one off the table. I would not risk the chance of spreading it out unless I absolutely had to between the two. And I would focus one down and then take my chances with the surviving one.
Well, we have to assume that the bracketing thing is going to stay because the codexes are going to keep their thing. So, you know, maybe there could be a calculated risk if you get something to, I know we know things always hit on six, but if you can get things down to that bottom tier, then
true.
Maybe you've improved your odds of it, but it's still, I agree with you. It could, especially with auto hit weapons, it could all go real bad for you.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, one of those flamers or something. I mean, and you consider, you know, so Leviathan with 20 shots, I admit I'm not entirely sure of the exact amount, the output of a Dread Knight, but by at least removing one of them, you don't have to worry about that many more dice coming at you, even at a reduced rate.
And no one's looked at the Gatling silencer or the heavy incinerator.
How much does that total out to?
I think the Gatling silencer is it 12 shots of strength 4?
Sounds right. Yeah.
And 12, then I think the heavy incinerator is 2d6. I can look this up. I don't have to guess.
No. I mean, either way, that I wouldn't want to take those chances, especially the heavy incinerator. I mean, you assumedly, you've already taken Overwatch from one or both. And so it's already bad enough. You already got to get there. I think horde armies definitely have, you know, you take boys or gaunts or demons or something where you have a large number of the models, you know, you can at least stick into the combat. But you've got to watch out when you've got those elite melee armies and you're getting chewed on by Overwatch and getting shot at in the following phase. I just think it's best to take the dice off the table as much as possible and not risk spreading it out if you could help it.
Yep. Yeah, that's probably very, very sound advice. I mean, but I guess in this type of day and age, is there really an advantage to get up there and hugging something if you can't kill it?
Yes. So I still think, and that's what, you know, so if something was going to stay alive, I would rather take it at minus one to hit than at its full, you know, its full value.
Yeah, okay, especially, fair enough.
You know, don't, yeah. I mean, you know, it's only 16% margin. But like you said, if you can even, you know, so taking my berserkers, for example, if I can at least bracket them down, and then they're shooting at, you know, so let's say I go for the Dread Knight first. And let's say I magically was able to get through, you know, obscuring terrain. So I didn't take, you know, flamers, the 2d6 flamer auto hitting on Overwatch. And so I was able to take a Dread Knight down and then I move on to the Leviathan. If I can reduce it a little bit, yeah, I'll still take it hitting me on fours versus twos and then also having to get shot at by everything else. What we haven't really seen, and I'm not saying that it's going to happen. I'm just saying we haven't really seen if other units are going to be able to shoot into units that are engaged. And if, you know, we just don't know if that's changing. I'm not saying I've seen anything remotely about that. I just
wonder
see, you
know, if there's going to be something, sorry to jump in, I wonder if there's going to be something in there about pulling casualties to where can you pull yourself out of engagement with the casualties you take?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so I'm just interested to see, you know, we've seen a pretty healthy amount of what they've been kind enough to show us mechanic wise, but we can definitely say we haven't seen everything. And so without speculating too much, there's just, I still think there's plenty more of the book to open up and figure out for the benefit of melee armies too.
Oh yeah. That's the thing is right now we're starting to, we have big puzzle pieces, but we don't know where they connect. It's kind of laying out in the middle of a smaller table.
Yeah, absolutely.
But this is the fun part, man. I do think that we need to know interactions of things.
Yes.
Are we going to see an example of something with a larger engagement range?
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, and that's, yeah, exactly. I mean, Age of Sigmar has varied engagement ranges. You know, I was talking to someone else about this in regards, because someone brought up the definition of engagement range with me, and I was... My default answer is I hope engagement range is everybody is the same, because as I love the game, I love the intricacies. Having the same engagement range across the army is one less thing you have to be concerned about in variance. However, it would still be exciting if you had something. I mean, it makes sense, right? If a knight had an engagement range of, say, 4 inches, right? Or 4 inches with a chainsword versus 2 inches with a storm gauntlet.
Yeah, I'm starting to see you can punch over things. So yeah, you got your little line of grots right there touching him, but he's reaching over and he punches the battle wagon.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that it'd be awesome, right? Like it would, and it's still well within the realm of it. It's still well within the range of it, and it would make those big things have just that much more of a presence. And so I could see it. I mean, I could see something having a rule. There's nothing stopping it, right? Like a special rule on a data sheet that says this model's engagement range is 2 or 3.
Yeah. Yeah. I think
it's pretty awesome.
I mean, I could easily see like a Bloodthirster or something, you know, especially the woman that has like the axe or the hammers on the end of chains or whatever.
Don't get me excited, Paul. I'm sitting here looking at 4 of them over
on
my table.
Okay. That's what I brought you here for, man. So let's think about, you know, with what you've seen so far, do you think an army of, I mean, is the rule of 3 going to be there? Probably. But remember, that's an FAQ. That's not printed in any books, like as far as rules goes or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, it was a chapter approved deal. It was definitely an add-on deal to 8th edition. You're right. I mean, there's nothing saying that the rule of 3 has to come back into it. They might. And I mean, who's to say they're wrong without further testing or seeing it play out on our end, that they might have determined they no longer need the rule of 3.
I don't think that's the case. So I think we'll still see it, because it's the fact that it exists is kind of a limiter a control mechanism that we can all just kind of get our heads around.
I agree. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, you sit there and say, like, what if there wasn't a rule of three? And I'm thinking eight bloodthirsters. But no, yeah. But really, like, you know, points wise, like, that's not going to, it wouldn't fly in our 2000 point layout. But well, again,
there would be things like, especially some of these armies that have lower, probably a lower point cost, you could have that have six elite slots in the battalion. Sure. You know, you just take six. Yeah. Whatever the most exciting thing is. And I think it would, I think the game without this rule of three would quickly turn into that.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the early stages.
I mean, there's sure. I mean, as we go out of ninth, I mean, there's plenty of good, great things. I mean, like, you know, even Castellan robots, as I mentioned, I mean, there's a lot of great things that to be spammed. And so I do think it forces degrees of diversity. I don't think that's a bad thing by any means. I think that rule of three does a good job in within the confines of the game.
So
I mean,
that's a fun question though. It's the bloodthirsters. Do you see yourself at least sleeving up three of them?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was doing, you know, of course I was doing it. I mean, I was doing it less than a year ago.
Yeah, but you might win six games in a row.
It was, I mean, yeah, no, the, I mean, not just, you know, from what came out of Psychic Awakening recently, but them being able to get there, being monsters, taking into account. I mean, it might be that there's now maybe some play in the different variants of bloodthirsters. I mean, it's some people are surprised when I tell them that there are three different versions of bloodthirsters. There's not just the one that I'm always running that has more attacks.
And, are you kind of smart-brained in that, or is that the fourth?
That's the fourth, actually. There's the one of them actually has a ranged, like a real, like a ranged weapon that it can, it's almost like a flamer.
I said it breathes fire, right, or something, right?
It's like a roar, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So putting that on top of everything else, like, I mean, it's just one more thing to add to them. And now they're able to, you know, it's an auto hit deal. And so it's just adding a flamer to them. And now they're able to do it in melee combat. I mean, you know, that's another win for them. And I don't see why. I'm interested to see some of the other rules to it. And, you know, so with the recent Psychic Awakening material, you know, people talking, they're admittedly that all the greater demons got some really cool buffs. But for me, the bloodthirsters, I mean, I have definitely played with it firsthand to see that ability to move 12 inches to fly. When you talk about a board edge, when you talk about shrinking the board for me, and then I've got the ability to come in out of deep strike requiring only 7 inches, and I can reroll my charge rolls, that's pretty awesome.
I want to talk about that for sure. As excited as you are about bloodthirsters, I'm excited about great unclean ones.
Oh, yeah. Those things are going to be hard to pick off.
Well, with the boar shrinking, with them getting the avalanche of rotting flesh or whatever it is, you know, and then being able to potentially, we saw something about Death Guard being able to spawn in, you know, have some poxwalkers crawl up out of the ground. But you mentioned that with that 9-inch exclusion, do you think that 9-inch exclusion is going to be a bigger deal now because can, for your opponent, it's easier for them to spread out and cover more of the ground because there is less ground.
So that's a big thing, period, that we still have yet to see is what reserves and deep striking looks like and what the changes are to that. And I have, you know, in every major update, there has been some kind of adjustment to reserves and deep striking. And it has always greatly affected the game. And in regards of, you know, our greater demons being able to get there, that is there's a huge amount of potential in impacting the ability to do something across the board. And that's, you know, takes me back to units like infiltrators, you know, Phobos, Space Marine infiltrators that block out 12 inches.
Oh, see, that's
technically,
you know, exactly where I was going is like, that's a lot of the board. That is what, how much percent more of the board is that? They're blocking out 13% more of the available space.
It's massive. I mean, you know, 2 feet of the if lengthwise, 2 feet of the 5 feet available. I mean, that means one model is blocking out 40% of the board.
Yes, nobody did the math on what I just said. I totally did that. But it's
40% of the board.
Yeah.
Yeah. By one model. A Phobos captain does that. He blocks out 24 inches.
Yeah, that's pretty massive. Crazy.
It is crazy. I mean, you know, it's sure we played 6 feet by 48. You know, now we go to 5 feet, but at the same time, like that's still enough, and people will feel it. If they haven't felt it, they will. They sure will.
I just think that it's drying up those opportunities to creep in on folks. And then where I'm going with that is that might be its own enough control mechanism. Like it may exist the exact same way now, 9-inch exclusion, can only come in at certain times or whatever, have to burn the command points to be able to do it in a lot of cases. Oh, and by the way, they may not even get an opportunity to come in this way. They might just be walking off the board edge.
That's right. No. Yeah. Between those two, another good thing to think about in regards of board space and whatnot is flyers. Flyers coming, like you can't predict. We don't know exactly how they fly off or how they fly back on, but a flyer that comes back in on the third turn and then denies you board space, if it does in fact deny you board space and your ability to come in, I mean, you know, a smart player with flyers coming off the board edge could do very well at effectively blocking out units like that.
We did get to see some information about how flyers may not be things that block units that way anymore.
That's true. You know, and I'll be interested to see. I think the caveat to that is that regardless, footprints are always present, right? Like they might, you know, you're right. Flyers might not have anything to do with that, but you're never going to, or I don't expect, I won't say never. You don't expect that you're ever going to be able to put models on top of models.
Yes, that's fair.
So, you know, that, and in that case, that's where, again, going back to some of the horde concepts, take like, you know, what we saw with Death Guard and Poxwalkers, being able to bring Poxwalkers up out of the ground and just occupy space. It's just a thing.
Yeah, that's one of the best things, just sitting around, scoring points or denying your opponent points and just sitting around. But I mean, like, that's sometimes you've just got things that are not worth it to shoot at. And they're just doing work for you, you know. But that's where I've been thinking about is these 9-inch armies and stuff that relied upon the 9-inches and stuff before, you know, is it going to be even more powerful? Are they going to be able to do more stuff? And what really got me on the train of remembering this was you mentioned the 7-inch charges. So things that can come in in 7, kind of open it up. Like that's even more powerful now because they can fit into tighter spaces.
That's right. And that's, you know, so gene stealers, the part with gene stealers, they're the you know, gene stealer cults, I should say specifically, and their blips and their special little mechanics for deploying, whether, you know, at the beginning of the game or whatnot. I mean, they still prevent units from moving within certain distances of them. But that doesn't mean that some of these things, again, like infiltrators, being able to move forward and then suddenly block out their ability to move in on those blips. I mean, there's a lot to that, to the space, to the location. I mean, you know, a Raven Guard player that can move those infiltrators up forward. I mean, I guess you don't even need to worry about infiltrating them because they come in, you know, they go forward of the deployment zone anyways. But there's just a lot to that could really, with the shortening board edge, really have a lot to do with deployment space. And I think that's going to be very interesting. I've always sponsored that board control was a big deal. I think that it's even that much more of a deal once we take out a foot of board space.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, I know where people keep saying it's the mid.
Correct. But I mean, I think it's already been kind of pushed informally. I think there has been some formal sources that have said that the minimum is going to kind of be the initial standard out the gate. So I admit that I'm kind of working forward with that minimum.
It's always like the table space that we play on is actually, I think, always been the minimum. I mean, let's not forget that basilisks have 120-inch range or something like that. I mean,
yes. Yeah, Manticore's exactly.
260, and there's stuff in the Forge World book that's 500-inch range or something like that.
Right.
Or table wide. I mean, there are things like there's, but we just kind of agree on whatever that construct is that we're going to play on. And I don't think people are going to need too much incentive to want to change it up because of all the other stuff that it brings to the table. Like I've heard people that say, well, I'm still going to play on my 6x4. Like, okay, that's great. But then your friend's going to come over and I don't really like the way my arm plays on a 6x4 table. I like a 5x4 table.
Right.
And I built my army to play on the 5x4. Okay. Well, I guess we can play it this time. And then you get wrecked. And then you're like, well, I built my army playing with 5-0. And, you know, then we're all playing.
I mean, it, you know, there's a lot of validity to that. And going back and forth, you know, I totally acknowledge. I mean, I'm sitting here looking at my realm of battle battle boards that I've got that, you know, they're all, you know, six boards that, that make a 4x6 table. I totally understand. I get it. But in most cases, I'm kind of with the general crowd of I'll mark a foot off. I actually appreciate the extra space. I understand, you know, a lot of event runners, and I totally get them talking about, you know, more people, more space that they're going to be able to fit in. I kind of appreciate the fact that I'll have that much, like a sideboard to be able to kind of prep my models and set my codexes on and or my iPad and all kinds of stuff. Like I don't mind having the extra space.
I agree. And look, this it's just one of those things to where don't cut your mats.
Like, sure.
Don't
sure.
cut any. I mean, I know there's people out, but I mean, why not? Like if you've got a bunch of mats, cut up a couple. Like it's fine. Yeah. But if you have that piece of material, you know, there's nothing that says you can't just define where the map ends and then set a couple of, you know, frosty beverages down.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've got several of those mats. I'm sure you got a couple, you know, the when it comes down to it, if you really are, you know, doing the space deal, like to an extent, the mats aren't so, they don't stick out so much, or they're not so heavy or difficult to deal with that they can't overlap even. Like I wouldn't fold them over, but if you're really pushing for space as an event runner, like they could arguably go over one another without making a significant, you know, one way or the other. But I agree, I wouldn't cut them. I'm not a fan of cutting them. I just think, you know, I was looking at I've seen where people had those dividers, you know, at some of the game stores where it's almost like a wall or like a terrain piece that's as long as the table and it just kind of cuts off the table. That's fine. You just move it a foot to the left or the right or what have you.
In most cases, like, or at least in some tournaments that I've been to where you've played on what is just a bank of tables all end to end on each other long end. And sometimes those tables are 10 feet wide. They're not even 6 or 8 feet wide. They're 10 feet long.
Right.
The organizer just starts on one end and goes 6 feet, puts a piece of tape, goes 6 feet, puts a piece of tape, you know, and that's what you get. Although I think if I'm wanting to run a fancy event, like a premium event, I'm probably going to cut mats to size or have.
Well, yeah. I mean, if that's, you know, if you want to cut the mats or whatnot, I do think that I wouldn't put it past any of the companies, and not like in a bad way, but I could totally see them producing the appropriate mats for the new format here shortly.
Yeah, absolutely. Except for my home play, I'm not cutting up anything. We're just going to play on a smaller part of it.
That's right.
Yeah. So now I don't know. There seems to be some pressure from folks to join one camp or the other. And as long as you have a flat place to play that does meet the quote unquote minimum size to play on, that's really, I think, the only where it concerned. And again, we don't know all the nuances of these rules. Like there could easily be some stuff in here that compels you to play 3,000 points.
Right. Yeah. No. I mean, I did appreciate seeing that. I did like the, you know, I mean, I think they've always kind of had that, you know, the next level up. I think we've shot around 2,000 points. I know, you know, there used to be 1,850 and people were bouncing around with 1,500, but seeing the 3,000 points on there and the recommended board size for 3,000 points, I thought that was cool. I think it'd be interesting. I'd be interested to see if they scale deployment zones accordingly with that. I think that'd be cool. I will say, I think, you know, if you do go to a 4x6 versus a 4x5, you know, or the you know, 60x44, I do think that just from where we started with this conversation, it will advantage, obviously, I think it will advantage in most cases a shooting army if you go to a 6x4. Makes sense, right?
Could be. You know, that puts things a little bit out of whack. Well, Red, let's take a break. I'm going to come back and insert a spot with John Higdon from Twisted Dice.
Cool.
You and I, how about we come back and talk about how to buy secondhand?
Sounds good.
See you in a minute.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games, Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to a community spotlight segment on Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. I'm joined tonight by the legendary Ace Face.
Hello. Hello, Paul. Good to be here, as always.
Man, Mr. John Higdon, thank you very much for joining.
My pleasure. My pleasure, mate.
So, you know, we got something happening at 40K.
Oh, it's a crazy time, really crazy time in the hobby. It's super, super exciting. You know, it's just, there's so much going on. You don't know where to look, do you?
No, I mean, but you got to be excited, right? I mean, we've seen some rules today for like monstrous creatures and how they behave, and you know, that's what you play, man.
Man, exactly. They are speaking my language, literally. I think I can't remember the exact word for word, but it was kind of like, you know, if you like playing Nidzilla lists, and literally they could have put my name at the end of that sentence because that's my list. So yeah, I'm so excited because the you know, making that type of unit really playable in a competitive format excites the living daylights out of me. So yeah, it could be such a great addition for me because that's my gold.
You're pretty much set. Like, you have these big bugs and you're ready to go.
Yeah, man, they're sitting here looking at me now on my hobby shelf, saying, you know, play with me.
Hundreds of eyes, yeah, and yawning mouths.
Yeah, and I've got, you know, to be fair, I've got probably more monsters than I have got little bugs. So yeah, for me, it's exciting time. And I've been trying to persevere with these bugs anyway, and they've seen quite a lot of play, I think, when you kind of play around with different tactics with them. But it's never been the easiest thing to do, which is why a lot of players have steered clear of them and have gone to generally either a horde mentality or at least a kind of a gene stealer heavy kind of tyrannid lists.
Well, the rules which weren't doing many favors, right? I mean, you had terrain issues, you had screen issues, you had being locked in combat issues. I mean, there was just a mounting number of obstacles that they had to overcome, but it sounds like some of that stuff is being, you know, curtailed, trimmed back.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the ability to be able to now interact much more with your shooting monsters when they get kind of tied up, which is always the problem, because Tyranids, big monsters, as much as they look really scary, as soon as you put a big gun on them, on the whole, if they get tapped in combat, they are absolutely useless at fighting. You know, even some of the big, more combat units struggle with a big horde of models that attack them, but particularly the shooting bugs, they just can't get out once they're stuck. So the ability to have your Exocrine or your Carnifex or whatever kind of shooting bug, Tranifexes, when they get touched in combat, the ability to still operate is exciting and will definitely make them a lot more scary. And you know, who knows, we might see more buffs to the actual, you know, the monster itself when it comes to combat. They definitely, you know, seem to be talking about really pushing the bigger monsters and the bigger units into the forefront. So it sounds like really exciting times.
Yeah, even if the other stuff gets better also.
Yeah.
I think if everything else gets better also and these things still get better, that's still good.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll even take it the fact that, to be honest, a smaller table, my big monsters that are running across the board will manage to get there quicker, because that's always been the other problem is, you know, when you've got these big beasts, it's generally quite difficult to get them where you need to because they've never been really quick enough on the whole. But the fact that they're going to be that little bit closer is really, really going to help them as well. So, I see lots and lots of bonuses from what I'm seeing. It's a really, I think it's a really quite exciting time to be a Tyranid player, but hopefully it's an exciting time to be, you know, quite a lot of factions, because there seems to be a lot of things that will be benefiting a lot of armies. So, all I'm seeing is good stuff, right?
Yeah, that's kind of me too. It seems like a rising tide is literally lifting all boats that people play with. You know, we're going to talk a little bit about close combat on this show as well, about the closing the gap a little bit easier.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, I don't want to be redundant with some of the other stuff on the show, but you're basically getting a free turn of movement out of it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and the more interaction that brings it in, I mean, the more it reminds me of, you know, when you look at Age of Sigmar is much more of a combat orientated game. And this kind of bringing in those boundaries is definitely going to, I think, with that combined with the terrain, is going to make it exciting time to run that type of army. So yeah, I think the combination of the two means that maybe not one stronger than the other, maybe we have got a much better of balance. At the moment, the game is very much shooting orientated, and if you have a really good shooting army, you know, against a combat army, it's a really tough card to play. But now with a combination of the terrain and the board sizes, you know, then you've got a great advantage potentially for those combat units, but then the shooting big monsters and tanks can't be locked down. So you've really got a kind of an interesting dynamic there. So it's going to be really fundamentally a different kind of battlefield. and something that's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out and what kind of floats to the top to be the meta style of play. So yeah, really, really exciting.
Yeah, what I haven't seen anybody really talk about yet is there's still that 9x exclusion rule in a bunch of stratagems. So that likely won't change. Do you think it's going to get harder to do those infiltrations and deep strikes and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's definitely going to be resource really dependent. And that's, I think it's going to be interesting how, I think you're going to have to be really quite smart how you manage your resources, because it looks like there's going to be a lot of use of those CPs and that they're going to be very, very vital. So to be able to plan them out, what you're going to use them to trigger, what part of your army is going to come from where, going to do what, seems like that's going to be one of the biggest challenges and one of the things that we're going to need to master to even a greater level. I think some players already plan their CP management quite heavily now. You speak to a lot of top players and they know that they've got, you know, five CP for this and two CP for this, and actually they can't afford to use any rerolls. And I think to a degree we might be in that same kind of boat going forward, that you'll need some for this and some for that, and you'll really have to manage them closely, which I don't think is a bad thing if it gives us flexibility on the battlefield.
Yeah, I mean that's fair enough. I don't either. I think that's going to, the whole way people approach movement in their screens and what they're comfortable doing now is going to have to change a bit. And
yeah,
I think we're going to further complicate that. I shouldn't complicate it. It's a bad word. Make it interesting.
Shake it up.
How we know terrain is going to work, you know, and the deployment zones. I mean, this is a kind of a way to really explore the game in a much different way. I think the people that more quickly adapt to that are going to do better once this edition drops.
Yeah, I think so. And it's really great the way that we've got these real key and huge changes, but still within a kind of familiar backdrop and a familiar kind of rule base. That again is a really great place to be, because these rules changes and these fundamental changes to the way the game operates will completely throw up in the air everything that we consider good, bad, indifferent because of those fundamental changes. But yet at the core, we're still all going to have a basic idea of how to play the game, which is a really good place to be. We're not going to be in the same place that we were from 7th to 8th, almost having to kind of rewrite the book. All we're going to have to do is really look at the armies that we own and the games that we're playing with a kind of fresh pair of eyes around what's going to work and what's not going to work.
Ball
and
predators.
That's good.
That's what we're going to look at it with. We're going to look at it through a fresh new lens of Promethean Flamers.
Why not? That sounds good for me.
I was hoping to rile you up a little bit playing Tyranids, because that, you know, those in theory, the Flamers and stuff should be like the bane of the Tyranids. But I guess it didn't affect you because you're mostly
big bugs.
Stompy list, yeah.
Yeah, we don't care about your Flamers. Those matches at our feet, will squash them.
Well, man, you are an amazing content producer. Where can people find you?
So now I solely work out of Twisted Dice. So a lot of people where I've started kind of producing a lot more heavy Tyranid content over on Twisted Dice have kind of popped up and said, oh, I didn't know you were here. But yeah, so I used to run Ace Face as my channel. That I've closed down now. You can still see the back catalog of videos over there, but I work out of Twisted Dice, so you can go over on YouTube and search for Twisted Dice. You can't miss us. We do loads of glossy dice by dice battle reports, but in the last few months we've really started to focus on tactics videos, and we've started looking at narrative videos, painting tutorials. I'm not a bad painter, but Darren, the other guy that works on the channel, is a really talented airbrush painter, and he's got some great tutorials that he's putting out over there. So there's loads for all sorts of people across the kind of the hobby spectrum. So there's loads of stuff to kind of to get stuck into there. We also have a podcast that comes out every week, which is The Tip of the Spearhead, which is kind of a, it's a kind of tongue-in-cheek, quite a kind of lively you know, a bit of fun with what's kind of hot at the moment within the community. And we kind of put our own spin on it. It's definitely a not safe for work one, but it's a lot of fun if you kind of want to have a bit of a laugh for an hour. So we've got that, and we're really, really active on Instagram, and over on Facebook as well, which you can either follow all my stuff on Ace Face over on Instagram, or you can check out the rest of the guys' work at Twisted Dice. So loads and loads of stuff going on.
Awesome, man. Well, have a great rest of your night. Thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thanks very much, Paul.
You're listening to Forge the Narrative.
Hey, everybody, we are back. This is going to be a big thing. People are going to be looking to shift their position in their figures. Either going to be wanting to pick up to go long, or they want a short position on the Space Marines and other stuff. There's, with the addition change, there's bound to come people that want to change their army. So not everybody just collects armies on their shelves. Some people like to move them. Some people like to pick them up. And if you are picking them up and you haven't gotten them from one of our fine sponsors, then maybe it's some of the trade sites or aftermarket sites, like whatever. I've done online trading for a long time. I like the kind of the flow, the liquidity of some of the things. I have stuff that I'm always going to have. I'm always going to keep it. And, but then something just catches my eye and I want to build it up and see how it plays a little bit, and I'll move it, or I'll go out and I'll win some tournaments and I'll get some store credit. I'll buy some things on the shelf with the store credit. And then I realize that I don't need that. I overbought, or the army that I was working for, I changed my mind on. And so it's time to move it on. So I trade, buy, and sell stuff all the time. Over the years, I have learned to look for things, and I've learned to when to spot like what I really want. I've learned to just how to maybe get a deal done, maybe how to get something that get a little bit something extra. You need one thing, but he doesn't want to break up a set, so you got to buy them both. How do you buy them both? I've learned that when it comes time to you reach a level of depreciating returns when you're having to educate someone that it actually costs money to ship things. So therefore, it could make the deal uneven. You with me so far, Ed?
Yeah. So I'm with you on a lot of points. I admit I don't do so well moving it myself. I like to collect. I don't typically get rid of too much on my end, but I do collect. And I will say my Necron army and actually a lot of my Chaos Space Marines were rescues or you know, secondhand purchases. By and large, I've taken a lot of one thing and brought it into something else. And it's been a very interesting endeavor collecting, because I definitely didn't just pick it up in one go, you know, in one purchase. I had to acquire it in pieces here and there. And, you know, there was a lot of work one way or the other to get it to be a cohesive army. And so I definitely learned a lot in that process of going through it. And I, some of my peers will laugh if they hear me talking about this, because a lot of them will joke that sometimes when I get into deals and whatnot, I kind of have a tendency to come across as Rick from Pawn Stars. And, you know, that they'll lay out this really big deal and it's a good deal. And I'll tell them too. I'll say, hey, that is a fantastic deal. You're really offering a solid
deal. Dead
on with
the money right there.
Yeah, but I will give you $20 for that. And they're like, you're crazy. And I'll be like, well, I mean, here's a, and you know, that's an exaggeration. But when it comes down to it, I know that there's kind of some forward effort, and where, you know, when you're recovering projects from other people, if you're not buying it as a finished item and you want to do your own thing with it, you definitely have some additional effort in recovering someone else's project.
That level of sweat equity is on yourself. It should be valued. And I mean, not everyone can look at it that way, but
right.
You know what it's worth to you. And
exactly.
You know that you can buy that. Yes. Okay. Yeah. He's selling it for personal, but then you've got to put 10 hours worth of effort just to get it into the fact for you to use it again.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's where, I mean, I, some of it is opportunity cost. Some of it is, you know, your own, your own effort and what you have to do to turn it around. And you're exactly right. It does actually cost me, if you can rate your own time, if you can kind of get the idea down of what you think is fair, and hopefully you've got the ability to communicate that to the person that you're making a deal with to kind of reach that understanding so that it kind of factors into the deal one way or the other, or at least that's what I try to do. The best deal
in any situation is the one you both walk away happy from.
Yes,
absolutely. And sometimes you're going to need encouragement to be happy, and so were the counterparty.
Right. Yeah,
and I don't mean encouragement of sweetening the deal. He may need to go on a journey with you to come to how you got your value assessment, and then it's their choice to respect it or not respect it. And
that's right.
Do a deal with somebody else.
Yeah. No. And there's plenty of cases where I've made my offer. I've explained where, and the person has at least been respected why I made that offer or what I'm factoring in. But I've turned around and I've been like, hey, look, I get it. If you want to try and get your monetary value out of it at what you're looking for a specific reason, just like you said, if the person's moving on or has some other goals beyond that, they're not just getting out of the game or not just looking to just, kind of slash and burn with what they've got and go on with it. If they're looking to move to get new items, to get some of the new material, the Necrons, as we mentioned, new Necron material is coming in. The old Necron material is by no means going away necessarily, but some people might be looking to just kind of to jazz it up.
Yeah, they want
a certain extent
brand new on their hobby desk.
I mean, that's right. Yeah, I mean that's a thing. There's plenty of us suffer from that malady, right? And when you consider, Primaris and whatnot, it's going to happen.
What you just described a second ago, people are going to go, oh, that's a lowball offer. But it could also be a situation to where, like, let's say I come to the table with a painted miniature and I value the paint job. I value the time that I put into it. And if you don't, then we have to have a conversation about, well, this is why I'm asking the price that I am. And then you have to have a conversation about why you are offering the price that you are.
Right. Yeah. And, no, I mean. Absolutely.
Sometimes the paint job is worth it, but if you're trying to match something totally different, you can't have this red guy hanging out in this orange army or blue army.
Yeah, no, I mean, and you've done some painting for friends, and I apologize, I'm not totally familiar. You may have done commissioning or whatnot. I've only done a very limited amount of kind of painting by commission or what have you, by no means of professional caliber or anything like that. But my own effort, at least in that regard of rating it, I kind of did. There's definitely value attached to that. On the flip side of that, going into some things, I don't like some color schemes. I don't like, and I do recognize that some colors are more difficult to remove than other colors. And, if someone showed me
if you prime this thing with enamel, I'm looking at it, my offer is going to be a lot less.
That's right. That's right. And it's that, objective medium is going to move one way or the other in regards to that. I mean, I admit I have a really hard time appreciating yellow paint jobs. It's very difficult for me to appreciate that. And seeing a model in yellow, if someone offered it, it's hard for me to not be biased to a certain extent where I don't depreciate the value simply because of how it was painted yellow. That's a personal thing. Just putting it in frame of reference.
You're trying to move painted models, unless you're trying to move an entire army that you know is more competitive functions together or has enough options to where the person you're selling it to is going to be able to play whatever they want, you're probably going to take a hit on that cost. You've got to consider the effort that you put in, or even the commission money that you put in as basically a sunk cost.
Yep.
I'm not saying you shouldn't try to find the right buyer. You don't have to settle on anything. You don't have to sell it if you want. I'm saying it's going to be quicker if you do. And I don't want this entire segment. I know I've led us down this way. I don't want this entire segment how to get the best deal. I think that you have to. I want the segment to be about being realistic about what you're looking for.
Sure.
And I mentioned that sometimes you have to kind of convince people to come off what they want to do. Like somebody's wanting to sell an entire army and they don't want to split it up, and it's a giant army. It's worth $1,200, and they say they'll take $900 or something like that, which is it's a pretty good deal. That's like 30-something. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, and that's tough. That's tough. I mean, it's there's a lot to it, and there's a lot. I mean, but I'd tell for anybody that's hopeful for selling something at that level, there is quite frequently, and this goes to really where I'm leading into, timing wise, there are quite often the buyers are always there. It's just a matter of timing. And understanding where the game is and where the meta is, if something comes out and it's maybe not the best look for an army in the meta or something like that, it might be more difficult to off, you know, to try and sell off an army in a, at a certain time.
I know that the person would have easily, you know, they've obviously put out what their criteria for selling is. They want to sell it as a whole unit. But sometimes you can just lay the seed like, hey, I'm not interested in the whole thing, but I do want half of it. I want a third of it or whatever. So here's you now. I've now declared my interest. If you decide you'd like to sell that much of it, please. And that way you've communicated in a way that person, you're not trying to violate or go against what you haven't put them on the defensive. Well, didn't he read what I posted? You know, you're not putting them in that mindset. What you've done is just kind of open, crack the door for if the way they want it to go down isn't happening, you're there to at least give them something if all else fails. And that doesn't often work for me. Sometimes it works, I don't know, maybe 10% of the time.
Yeah. I've seen that too.
But you don't have to stop looking for what you're looking for, even though you floated that offer out to the guy. And heck, and sometimes they may come back to you and go, yo, I'm ready to sell for that, but you've already bought it. And then, you know, there's still no harm, no foul.
Yeah.
Education out there. And
for sure.
And sometimes you've got to, you know, say they do want to sell. They've got two Riptides and you only want one of them. Now, I don't see any reason to not tell the guy that you really only want one and then tell them the reason that you don't want the other one. Either you can't afford it right now. Maybe you don't say you can't afford it. I don't want to spend that much right now.
Sure.
Or it's not armed the way I want it to be armed, you know, because then you're giving him your honest objections. And then it's on them like, okay, you know what? I would still like to move them both at the same time. How about you take this one at my asking price and this one could be a little bit less.
Yeah.
You might walk away with two Riptides. Look, I don't know. I'm saying be on the lookout for this kind of stuff. Like, and there's different ways to engage folks. Like, this is a real thing. So I was engaging in a trade online. A sell. So I got some Nuon Sprue troops, duders. And in my post, I say, look, I sell everything 25%, 35% off. You know, it depends on, you know, what I've got. Cause I'm not a store. I don't have any cost basis of this. I've won this stuff or bought it 100 years ago. This doesn't have the same. I don't know what I might as well just be sitting there. Space at this point. And, but I say, you know, look, I've got a good idea of what I'm going to sell some of this stuff at a discount. You know what my discount is because it moves quickly and I don't have to think about it very often. When I decide I want it out, when it's gone, it normally gets gone pretty well. Mm-hmm. Again, not something that a business person can do because they're worried about all kind of stuff. It's just on the shelf for me. So when I declare the price, like, yo, okay, the cost at this, at that discount is $50. The guy's like, well, I'll buy, you know, or I want to give you 30 for it. Like, well, I can't do that because that would be discounting the thing at 75% off. And then I've got to pay shipping. So by the time you add in the $8 to ship to you, you know, we're basically at the price that I'm asking for right now.
Yep.
Well, you know, he's not going to buy. That person's not going to buy from me because I had to educate them.
Right.
So it's, I did. They're not in their journey of the secondhand market. They don't know that there's that essential of what is basically like a tax on the other side of the trade, which is somebody's got more shipping. And if you're trading with someone, you pay each other, you pay the shipping for your stuff that you're sending, and pay it to you. It's a wash. But if you're buying something from someone, they've got to factor in, somehow has to factor in that cost of the shipping.
Right. Well, and that's, so, I'll tell you what, in most eBay deals, you know, not to go too far down that road, but I zero in on free shipping as a buyer. I rarely consider most of the deals that have any degree of shipping.
Yeah, it's just a big deal.
It is.
Well, I mean, it can offset what you're actually paying. You know, like at some point, it's just you should support your local store. I understand that it has it or has that ability or opportunity because your distance is your way and they may not stock what you want. But yes, but it still costs to get something to your door.
Yeah.
I mean, Prime has, I guess, Amazon Prime has shattered our perceptions of that.
Not wrong. Absolutely. Yeah,
but you get what I'm saying, right? So this, and if you are the seller, you have to factor that in too, because you don't want to get to the post office and realize that you have to buy a box to put it. You got to buy some tape to tape, and then you've got to ship it to the person, and then turn your $20 sale into a $5 sale.
Yep, I mean, it absolutely factors in like that.
Now, again, you might be in a situation where you just want to get the stuff moved, and you don't care, or you're trading. Like, even if you're trading something that's giant and getting something, you're getting a blister pack from them. That's still how it works. You know, you can. That's when you maybe have a conversation about the disparity in shipping. If you're trading, typically the traders cover whatever shipping is in their place. But when you're a buyer, you cover the shipping in some way, or at least have a discussion about it from the seller. That's the shit. Yeah. That's the etiquette.
Yeah, I agree. It's a real thing. I mean, I know, you know, people have different rules, but I've seen that pretty consistently, you know, from different places I've been throughout.
But I love sometimes I'll find, you got to put it all together too. Sometimes you'll find the exact equipment that you need, or somebody has built the squad that you were going to build anyway.
Maybe
find it base coded in your colors. These are all, you never find this though. You never find it built the way you need.
Well, and that was kind of the nice thing about Necrons, right? Is that, I mean, for the most part, you knew they weren't going to go too far out of, typically they don't go too far out of a specific paint range.
They're silver somewhere on there.
Something like that, right? And so it wasn't too bad. Yeah. And going up from dark silver or black primer or what have you usually isn't too bad. Even if it's, you know, bright silver, still not too bad to adjust from that. Whereas, you know, Space Marines can be any flavor of the color. Chaos Space Marines can be quite different. Different yep. being an understatement.
Yep. I completely agree with that. And then, so sometimes you then go on to find like the actual sweet spot. Like if you happen to be looking for four grav cannons and you happen to find that one guy with Dev Squad selling them as four cannons, mm-hmm. but he's only charging you the price of the Dev Squad. You're actually getting out ahead on that deal. Same with roto cannons or whatever, Chaos Havocs.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. I mean, some of those things, whether it's a vehicle, that's something big too. When I was looking at whether Space Marine vehicles or Imperial Guard vehicles, finding the right turrets, trying to find the tanks that have the right, whether it's, because, you know, they used to, I know now the kits have more options, but it used to be kind of hard to find Punishers, for example. And so trying to find, you know, if you're lucky enough, you look through and you see that whether they've magnetized it, that's always nice. If they've gone through the effort to magnetize it, or if the sponsons they put on there are exactly what you're looking for one way or the other.
That's it. So just observe the rules of etiquette, pays the shipping, how you engage, what you actually can't, what you could ask. I guess you can ask for anything that you want, but there's some stuff that you know you're not going to get. Like and don't always, you know, lowball just for the sake of lowball. Try to appreciate the fact it's just going to speed the process up.
Right.
If you can both find a deal that you're happy with, because this is the time to trade, move around some plastic, you know, maybe save a little money. And it's not like you may really want to change. Maybe you have two armies and you want to get down to one. Trade one of those armies to beef up what your current one is.
Yeah.
You know, some stores have trade-in programs. The trade-in programs, what I've found is they really do lowball the offer, because look, it's like that Pawn Stars stuff you were just talking about, is that they do have overhead. Like when you get the army, it's not like it just magically appears on the web for someone else to buy. There's some amount of cataloging. There's some amount of storage. There's some amount. There's the cost of owning them. Somebody had to pay somebody to catalog them, kind of thing. Like it all adds up. Like, so they take in the army at a really, really low cost. So the person that's trading in the army doesn't get the credit near about what it's worth. You then get to turn, it's like alchemy. You then get to turn that into store credit to get whatever you want.
Yep.
You don't get as much of it as if you went out and did all the legwork yourself, but you're also not having to pay that store employee to catalog your stuff. You either.
Right. Well, and you've got, there's something to be said, in rules of business and whatnot. Money in the hand, now is worth a lot in comparison for most people, for a lot of people, it's worth that much more than it is, in the hand a month or 2 months or 3 months. You know, that opportunity might not be there. And so at least having the store that's with the trade-in program that's willing to do that, you at least have that more immediate venue that you can apply yourself against.
Yeah, you can turn that rusty 17 into a shiny new cannonist.
Right.
Or maybe you have three sets of Rusty 17, you need to turn it into a brand spanking new showroom floor quality Exorcist.
Right. No, again, in the matter of time, if that's what you got to do in that time available, like that's the option to take, right? Like, not saying you have to, but it is what it is. And
there's
so
options out there is what we're saying. There's different ways, depending on, it all comes down to equation of time. Time versus, your time and what it's worth to take. Ever cost. But yeah, what I found is no matter what you have, if you post it for long enough, a number of message or Facebook groups, it will sell. It just may take more time.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I know it's kind of a It's a weird topic to make exciting, but I think it's very important.
It is.
It's kind of a bit of the ecosystem of how models flow around. Because there's a lot of people out there. I used to know as soon as so and so would buy an army, I'm like, I'm about to get that same army for 30% off. I'm sick of it.
I mean, that's a real thing. There really is. I mean, there's some people that are in it for the immediate deal, and you know, there's some people like myself that stack up. I mean, I'm looking at boxes and boxes and boxes of armies just waiting to come out, whether it's the Necrons that haven't been unpacked, or you know, the one thing or another. But like it's there are plenty of folks out there that, you know, it's their way. It's not a bad thing by any means. They build the army, they play it, they enjoy it, they have a great time, and then they move on to something else.
Yeah, it's ultimately disposable. I mean, they see it as just that. These are just little plastic and metal toy pieces that I play this game with, and then when it's time for me to move to another set, then shed the skin.
Yeah, it's got to go somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely, man. But I'm looking forward to it. Anybody that knows me knows I kind of been low key painting demons and orcs these last 2 years or so, and definitely going to be playing my assault armies, but I think it might be interesting to test out these new armies because the format is changing. So it's going to inspire me to paint a couple of months before it. I've been trying to think about how I'm going to paint my second squad of plague bearers to actually look like they're squad marked. Like, I think I'm going to put a lot more of the contrasty yellow in with the camo shade to make them look a little bit more sick.
Cool.
You know, that kind of dark mucus or something.
Yeah. Like it's kind of turned almost spoiled.
Yeah, it's that first morning mucus after, you know, you spent all night with a cold.
Yep. Very familiar with that.
that's what I'm going to go for.
Okay.
Yeah. When you spit it up, it's got that slight, maybe like trace streak of blood.
Cool.
I could go on.
Yeah, graphic. I'm sure plenty of people appreciate that.
But that's what it's great for radio. But that's what I'm definitely going to do with the next set of plague bearers. We keep them all tied together.
And they've got plenty of stuff that between that. You know, they've got that Nurgle's Rot technical, plus the Khorne's, the blood for the Blood God technical, and on top of those two, you know, the color you've already described. I mean, it plays right into the plague bearers. I know their behavior is a little more jovial in nature, but they really do a good job of being able to convey just how repulsive they are. So that's awesome.
Looking forward to this. All the possibilities. Kind of feels like you're just looking down a well of endless possibilities. Design, and that is comforting and horrifying all at the same time.
I mean for those people who really like to break down the meta and like to refine it into, you know, this most efficient format, I think that we're headed into an open frontier where between melee and shooting, and I just think there's a lot of dynamic opportunity for almost any army out there to really jump into it.
Well, Red, that's the show for today. Hopefully I can get you on next week, talk more about this stuff. Do you command tanks?
I am an armor officer. I had the fortunate opportunity of serving as a company commander in a tank company. I did. I just finished up or about to finish up my time in the CGSC here. It's the major school in the Army. And so I am soon to be officially a major, and we'll see what's coming up next for me after that. But yeah, I have been a tank commander. I will not say that I'm currently doing that, though.
Well, that's good enough for me to talk tank tactics with you. So
I look forward to that.
All right, man. Have a good night. We'll see you next week.
See you, Paul.
Handle the truth.